You're listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, with service members from across the military sharing their stories of combat and survival. And now, here's your host, Mark Zeno.
Welcome into the Hazard Ground Podcast. As always, we appreciate you joining us each and every week. Before we get to this week's guest, which will share a pivotal story that is not related to combat, but one about the VA that everybody who's a veteran needs to hear, because his work was pivotal in making sure that veterans get the medical protections that they need through the VA. We'll get to him in just a moment. First, our normal announcements. As always, please give us a follow on all the social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hazard Ground Podcast. As well, make sure that you guys are leaving us Apple reviews. Those things help us out a ton. Give us 5 stars, the thumbs up. Tell us why you love the show. We certainly appreciate it. And speaking of thumbs up, smash that like button and subscribe button on the YouTube channel as well for the Hazard Ground YouTube. Watch all the shows right there on our YouTube channel. Don't forget about our promotion with Amazon. You go to our website, hazardground.com. You click on the Amazon button at the bottom of the homepage. It'll redirect you to Amazon. You can do all of your normal Amazon shopping. We'll get a percentage of what you guys spend, and then we'll donate it back to some of the charities and organizations you've heard featured here on the show. We're about that time, getting close to back to school. So if you got some back to school shopping to do on Amazon, please go to hazardground.com first. All right, this week's guest spent a total of 7 years between active duty and reserves in the Marine Corps, all prior to 9/11. He had multiple overseas assignments, including Cuba, Puerto Rico, Korea, Thailand, and Japan. But after his 5 years, got out of the military, and then many years later down the road, went back to the VA to handle a medical issue in which the VA completely misdiagnosed. And after going through a lot of pain and suffering and getting himself healthy once again, he took the fight to Capitol Hill and closed a 74-year legal loophole for veterans, and named the bill after himself, as he should have, the Tally Bill. But veterans will now see new medical malpractice protections because of his work. This is such an important story to tell. He is Brian Tally, joining us here on the Hazard Ground Podcast. Brian, welcome, and thank you so much for being here.
Mark, thank you for the opportunity, man. I sincerely appreciate it.
You know, I came across your story, and I told you when I reached out to you, I said, look, this is just like, wow. And I know for our hardcore audience that wants to, hear about combat per se, your fighting was all done in the halls and the corridors of Washington, D.C., making lives better for veterans through the VA. I mean, look, all of us who have been to the VA, myself included, have some level of a VA, quote, horror story. And that's not to say that there are bad people working there. That's not to say that anybody is out to hurt you or get you. But there's a lot of things that have been in place for a long time that have never been uncovered because, well, prior to the global war on terror, they had about 30 years of absolutely nothing to do for anybody. And so the systems got old and outdated and things needed to be reviewed. And lo and behold, it's guys like you that put the work in to go and review it and make life better for veterans. So at the forefront, I say thank you for the work that you have done. And I'm definitely interested in hearing the whole story. But first and foremost, from a health standpoint, we'll figure out everything that happened to you. But how are you doing health-wise now? Because you look great.
Thank you. You know, I'm doing much better than what I was back in 16, 17, 18, and 19, for sure. You know, every day's a struggle. You know, I live in chronic pain. I become a chronic pain patient because of the injuries that I sustain, in the VA with all the medical malpractice and negligence. But, you know, I've taken it upon myself to get 1% better every single day and do what I can to live the quality of life that, that I deserve and that my family deserves. And I lost a lot of time with my children and with my wife when I was laid up for years. And you know, like I said, the best I can right now to get some of those years back. So a lot of that starts with, just mindset and eating right and, you know, just doing, you know, making the healthier choices, if you will.
All right. Your Marine Corps career started way back in the mid-90s prior to 9/11, back in 1994. How and why did you join the Marine Corps?
I wanted to be the best. Plain and simple. Marine Corps recruiter was walking the halls of my high school in Woodland Park, Colorado, and I said, I want to be that guy. So really, at the end of the day, I was, you know, dead set on the Corps. Once I saw that recruiter, plus I was a fighter growing up in school from elementary school all the way up through high school. I was raised by a single mother and I didn't have that father figure in my life. And so I thought that a lot of the times I would handle my issues, you know, out on the playground, if you will, and I'd throw fists. And so I really couldn't go to college, even if I wanted to. And plus school was something I didn't really enjoy. So I got my high school diploma, and then I just went straight into the Marine Corps.
Did you know what you wanted to do in the Marine Corps? Was it, I mean, were you the guy who wanted to go kick down doors and you know, do all that stuff? Or were you just signing up because you just thought it was a good outlet, so to speak?
I just wanted to go fight. Yeah, I just wanted to go. I loved everything about the mission of the Marine Corps and what it brought to the table when it come to discipline. And you know, really being the young Brian Talley, the young boy who was really lost, growing up, you know, perhaps I was searching for some identity, maybe, you know, that father figure, that mentor, that I didn't have. I mean, I had so many of them growing up, but it wasn't blood related. It would be, you know, a lot of mom's boyfriends or, you know, friends and, you know, different husbands from, you know, 18 years of my life. And even though that there were some, a lot of really great guys that I did learn a lot from, I never really had that one father figure in my life. So I think the Marine Corps was definitely filled that role in helping me grow up to become the man I would, you know, eventually end up becoming.
Was basic training a challenge for you?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I ain't gonna lie. Yeah, it was a struggle. You know, again, not having that father figure in my life, but I got through it. It's, you know, like the majority of Marines, you know, if they say, yeah, it was great, it was simple, they're probably lying to you, but no, I mean, I struggled. But the struggle wasn't enough for me to quit and walk away. I accomplished my mission and earned the title Marine.
So you get to your first duty assignment. I mean, I listed some of the overseas assignments you had before that. Did you expect to travel the world? Where did you end up first?
I got sent to Camp Lejeune. And then from there, went on a couple of temporary assignments down in Cuba and Puerto Rico, and South Florida. And then, after that, went to Okinawa and spent some time in Okinawa. And then I would end up going to Korea and Thailand. I did some Cobra Gold stuff, a lot of training on the outside islands of Okinawa, Ishima, Ukiburu. And then after that, I came back here and was stationed at Camp Pendleton.
In all that time, when you don't actually get to go and fight, was there a part of you that was disappointed? I mean, you got to do some cool stuff overseas, I assume, but, you know, you signed up to the Marines to go fight. You never get a chance to do that. Looking back on that, was that a disappointment?
You know, I never really thought about it at the time. You know, I was always the one that was signing up to go on temporary duty assignments. And I mean, we did so much training, you know, so that's good. You know, I definitely took that away. But really, at the end of the day, is who gets lucky and who doesn't get lucky. You know, I know a lot of guys who have served in some very high combat roles, and I'm like, man, what was that like? I'm like, man, I was just lucky. I got that call. You know, I was one of, you know, 20 guys that got that call, and they're thousand of me to choose from. So, I mean, I got lucky. I was in the right place at the right time. So, you know, obviously, you know, you sign up, you want to go fight, but my time, that wasn't for me. You know, I never got that call. I never got that opportunity. So
you end up leaving active duty in 1999. Why?
My daughter was born. She had just been born at Camp Pendleton. And holding the baby, you know, as a sergeant, and I had reenlistment papers in my hand, and something just happened. You know, I think with me just holding my newborn child in my arms, that I thought that it was probably time to get out, because I've always been told is you're married to the Marine Corps and that's it. I wasn't quite sure if I could fully understand that now. At age 17, 18, and 19, and 20, I was married to the Marine Corps. And then when I turned 21, I felt like I was actually married to my wife and I was holding my newborn baby, and things needed to change so I could start to take care of my family.
So after 5 years of active duty, you mentioned earlier, you went to the reserves for a little bit, or?
Yeah, in Denver. Yeah, I did some reserve duty at Buckley Air National Guard. But, you know, that was, you know, very, it was a very short time, and it was, you know, weekend warrior stuff. And
yeah. Are you officially out of the military when 9/11 happens?
I was.
Did you want to get back in?
I actually went to the recruiter.
What did your wife say?
No, I don't remember what she said, actually, but I didn't end up going in.
Do you remember what the decision point was? Were you not happy with what they were offering you at that time, or what?
My ankle was completely jacked up, and I think it was like more of a medical, like, hey, you know, you're good. You know, we're not drafting anybody, you know, or anything like that. And so, and I think I had gained some weight, a few years after I had gotten out too. So, that just didn't pan out.
Okay. So you leave the military completely, two wars kick off, you know, for lack of a better term, and I don't say this to denigrate, but you know, you're on the sidelines for all that. And that's fine. That's, you know, everybody chooses a different path. You did your service, and there's nothing wrong with any of that, but you're living this whole life. And we fast forward now 15 years to 2016, or at least before then, I guess, is when the pain first initially showed up, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, January 2016.
Okay. So you start getting pain where?
I'm sorry?
Where did the initial pain start that you went to go get checked out?
So January 2016, I pretty much roll out of bed and I'm in so much pain. I would end up on my bathroom floor just trying to find some relief from the cold tiles. I know my wife was sleeping. It was in the middle of the night, about 1:30 in the morning. And my bladder was full. I couldn't go to the bathroom or anything like that. I waited for my wife to wake up. I was moaning and groaning for hours. And I said, babe, there's something wrong. I need to go to the ER. So at the time, my doctor was the VA. I'd always had pretty good care at the VA. And I would end up getting rolled into the VA Loma Linda in Riverside. And they took one look at me and they gave me a shot of Dilaudid, a shot of Kenalog, and a shot of methocarbamol. They would end up triaging me and giving me an X-ray.
What are those things that you just mentioned, just for the audience? Because I'm not even familiar with what the shots that they gave you were. Were they all pain?
It is what you get on the battlefield when you get shot. Okay. So it's very high-end opioid. And Kenalog and methocarbamol or other pain.
Got it. Okay.
Pain drugs. So, I mean, they were shooting me with a bunt, you know, and it was all in the buttocks, left and right. You know, I'm just getting all these shots. At this time, I'm in so much pain, I just wanted it to stop. And they triaged me. They looked at the X-ray, said, everything was fine. And that I had sprained my back, but I had told them that there was no trauma involved here, and there was something going on. And they would end up sending me home with a bag of pills, and I would go home. And 2 days later, we ended up right back at the VA's front doorstep there in the VA ER. And this time, I would end up getting rolled in a wheelchair. Because I couldn't walk, the ER was so busy, and I would end up having a panic attack on the ER floor. And that's when the ER nurse came out and she gave me a shot of Dilaudid to kind of calm my nerves down because I was in so much pain. And at this time, my wife begged and pleaded with them that I see a doctor, because the first time I was there, I never saw a doctor. It was just simply, being triaged and sent away by a clinician, by, you know, a nurse, if you will. And so,
real quick, Bill. I mean, this is kind of wash, rinse, repeat at this point. I'm in a ton of pain. They come in, they shoot me up and give me a painkiller, which, oh, by the way, in January of 2016, is kind of par for the course for the VA reaction to a lot of things. Here's some pills. Here's some drugs. You'll be fine. Go away. Like, right. It's kind of, you know, their MO at this point. And anybody who's been there in that time frame or the couple of years preceding that kind of knows that that's the direction that they would go. Did you have a certain level of frustration about the way you're being treated, or did you genuinely think that, like, look, they're doing everything they can?
Well, my wife, this second time in the ER, she very politely, she's a very amazing woman. And, you know, she's very, she goes, can you please give my husband a blood test or, you know, some diagnostics, an MRI or something like that, 'cause there's something going on. I was incapacitated. I was on so many drugs. I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't even think for myself. I couldn't use the restroom. I was being capped. And I mean, it was just an absolute mess. I mean, one day you're just, everything's fine. And then the next day you find yourself in this whirlwind nightmare, trying to figure out what's going on. At that point, they denied it. So they delayed, denied a blood test and an MRI. So it was all delayed and denied care at that point. They said, if we come back for a third time, that they're not going to see me until I see my primary care physician. So at that time, before we even left the ER, my wife called my primary care physician and stated that we needed to get in. It was an emergency, and that the ER would not see me until we saw her. So we would end up seeing her 2 days later in passing. We didn't even rate a room. I would stroll in there in a walker because I couldn't walk on my own. And this is when I was 38 years old and otherwise somewhat healthy of a guy. And she said that she agreed with the VA ER stating that I had a sprained back and to go home and stretch and to continue taking the pills I was taking.
Okay. Is she at least doing an exam?
No, this was in passing.
Oh.
And like, you know, in a hallway, because she didn't have time to see me. And if anybody, needed medical emergency services, it was me. I went from being good to go to being a walking dead man in a week.
Okay. So what happens next? She gives you the old, they are right, you know, go home and stretch. I assume you went home and stretched.
Oh no, I went home and I sat in my chair, and that's where I would end up sitting, in my chair for months. It was like I was a POW in my own home. My wife had to bring me all my own meals. Every 4 to 6 hours, she would hand feed me pills. And those pills were my lifeline. I think I was taking at that time in the beginning up to about 20 to 25 pills a day out of about 11 to 12 different pill bottles. And then that would end up going up to about 40 pills a day. As time went down, as my body started to get acclimated to all the drugs that I was taking, to go to the bathroom, I would have to slide out of my chair in a very, weird way to where I wouldn't hurt myself and drip into a pee bucket. And that's how I went to the bathroom, because it would take me anywhere between 45 minutes to an hour to pee. And so I would just bury my head into my chair when I was done, I would just move my pee bucket over, and my wife would empty my pee bucket every single day. And again, she would bring me my meals and all that stuff. I wasn't even barely eating anything. I mean, I was literally dying in my own home. It was freaky. My wife thought she was doing everything right. You know, she's calling all the time. She's trying to advocate for me. I couldn't advocate for myself. Like I said, I didn't even know what the hell was going on. I had a business at the time. I had employees not knowing if they were going to work. I had so many men dependent upon me. And I couldn't even, communicate with these guys because I'm just laying in this incapacitated state. My wife's waking me up every 4 to 6 hours to give me pills and to force me to eat a sandwich.
And this lasts for how long again?
That would end up lasting for about 2.5 months before we finally paid out of pocket for an MRI.
Okay.
In March.
So you go to pay out of pocket for an MRI, which isn't cheap. We're now what, middle of January, middle of 2016, rather?
We're in the beginning of March now.
Of 2017. Okay.
No, 2016.
Okay. So 2 months in. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. So it all started in January 2016. Now we're in.
Got it. Yeah. Okay. So you pay for the MRI. What does the civilian doctor tell you?
Says that you need surgery on your back. We found a bunch of damage in your spine, and you need to have surgery. And so we took that report to the VA, and we said, we told you that there was something wrong, and you need surgery.
I'm sure that went over like a fart in church in the VA, huh?
Yeah, that was like March 10, 11. I mean, don't quote me on these dates. I'm just
fine. It's fine. We get it. It's been 2 months. I mean, so how did they react when you said I told you so?
They said that the soonest they can get me in was December 12th, 2016.
So did your primary care physician ever pick up the phone and call you and say, my bad?
No. At that time, when I showed her, or when my wife showed her the copy of the MRI, is when she put in a consult for me to go see the surgeon at the main VA. So she didn't even call my wife back. She left a message. My wife left a message for the primary care. The primary care put in a consult for me to go see neurosurgery and the VA surgeon at the VA Loma Linda.
Did the civilian doctor at that point in time give you any, other than needing surgery, obviously, which is a major thing, but did they give you any other inclination to the level of what was actually going on inside your body?
No.
Did they not know? Could they not have known at that point?
No. Okay. They didn't see anything of what we were about to find out.
Gotcha. Okay. All right.
They knew is that there was a problem going on in there, and it needed attention.
Got it. Fairly. So you get the referral to go through the neuro guy. What happens next?
They said, well, you got to wait, or we can choice you out and we can see if if we can get it done sooner. So my wife said, yes, we need to choice him out. And at that time, President Trump had signed something into law that gave veterans choice enrollment to go out. If it was more of a 30-day wait, that veteran could request to be choiced out into the community care. And that's exactly what happened. So the VA, and it's not my pick. When that happens, it's not something that the veteran picks. It's something that the VA selects because they have a group of network providers that are involved. So the VA picked somebody in my area and stated that that would be my surgeon. So I went and saw that surgeon for the first time at the very end of March. And 1 month later, I would end up having surgery on April 30th of 2016. So it would be a four-month period where I lived in that chair where I was dying every day. I was dying a little bit. I was dying a slow, painful death.
And just to validate for the audience, Brian's not exaggerating when he says he was dying. Like literally he had something that would have killed him had he not had it addressed sooner rather than later. So that's not hyperbole or exaggeration. That's medical fact. You were dying. So you have the surgery. Does the pain subside after the surgery?
No. I would end up having this surgery.
Clarification, what was the actual surgery they performed?
So they performed a laminectomy and a discectomy on my spine.
So they removed discs in your spine.
Right. And, they went through my belly. They went through my back. And as I lay open on the operating table, the civilian doctor thought he was doing what the MRI said. Oh, he needs to have a couple of disc replacements. He's got this going on. We need to take this bone out. We got to do all that stuff. But when he opened me up, he stopped the surgery immediately, called an infectious disease because he said that my spine was oozing with inflammation and my spine had been bone uh, or uh, uh, it the surgeon stated that, and I quote, that my spine looked like it had been moth-eaten and that we needed to get an infectious disease in there so they could find out what was going on inside my spine.
Wow. So you wake up from the surgery to this news, right? Is that essentially what happens?
Well, I had a lot of anxiety going into the surgery. And, you know, because at this point, you know, four months in, I hadn't worked. We were beginning to lose things, you know, my vehicle, mortgage was starting to stack up, and I had so much anxiety just thinking of other stuff that I wanted to get the surgery and get back to work is what I wanted. I wanted to just feel better to be me again. So right. When I woke up, my wife told the doctor, do not tell him that he's got this crazy infection and that he almost died and should have died within 2 weeks. And now he thinks, you know, that he may have bone cancer and all this other stuff. So I wake up and they begin to test me for everything under the sun. So my wife said, yeah, everything went great. You're good to go. And I've got a catheter stuck to me. I've got a couple of drains, you know, stuck with me, tubes coming out of it. It was just kind of a wild thing to wake up to, but they were kind of tricking me for a little while until they needed to talk to me about some very, very serious stuff that was going on inside my spine.
Okay. So when does that conversation happen?
About 2 days later, once everything came back and stated that there was no cancers found, but there was a bone eating staph infection that was found that was aggressively eating my spine, internal organs, disc, bone, you know, nerves, you name it. So I was literally being eaten alive from the inside out for 4 months.
When you heard that, what was your first thought?
Unreal.
I mean, did you, was there any sense of anger that the level of treatment you got initially at the VA and the ER and from your primary care was so disregarded as that you actually had something?
Oh, I was very upset. This hit me like a ton of bricks, you know, and yeah, probably more shock than anything because we did everything right. You know, we did everything right. And that's the crappy part is when you do everything right and you still fall victim to something that is, you know, that could end up costing you your life. Is something that, you know, it's just very hard. It's a hard pill to swallow, if you will. And trying to figure out how I got this and, you know, the hows and the whys and all this stuff. I'm like, a simple blood test would have picked this up and they would have treated me with antibiotics that very first trip. This would have all been done. I would have went about my merry way and carried on with my life in a couple of days. I would have been fine. But my life changed. My life has been forever changed because of that.
And that's what I mean. Like you had requested the blood test and were denied. I'd be pretty pissed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was upset. You know, I've always been a very level-headed guy. I've always been a guy that, you know, doesn't lose his bearing. I mean, what do you do? You've been through this and you realize that now you've gone through some egregious medical malpractice and gross negligence that's now caused permanent injuries all up and down my spine. Down and through my bladder, kidney, I have cognitive issues now from all of the pills that I've been on for years and years and years now, all the way down to my toes and, you know, all the way up to my neck. I just had to have another spinal surgery and it's something that I'll always continue to have because of all of the, severe damage that, this infection left behind. It's something that has forever changed who I am as a person, you know, as a man, as a husband, and as a father.
What did they tell you about how you could have possibly gotten it? I mean, there's really no way to know when and where you catch a staph infection. I mean, it could be a 100 different things, right?
Well, they called in a special infectious disease doctor. It was the same infectious disease doctor that treated Magic Johnson. I walked into his office a couple weeks after my surgery for the first blood draw, just to kind of check my infection level, because it took a long time to get rid of the infection. It took 4 months. So it took, for every month I had it, it took a month to get rid of it. So I was on a PICC line for 4 months, and then I took another oral antibiotic for another month after that. But I walked into his office, and there's all these pictures of Magic Johnson and him on the wall. And I remember, you know, his battle with HIV when it first came out. And so I know I had a really good doctor on my case, and he stated to me that I'm very lucky to be alive, that I should have died within 10 to 14 days. Sepsis should have set in, and your body, your internal organs should have all shut down, and that would have been the end of you. And then what? I've got a beautiful wife and 4 kids, and they're younger at this time. You know, this was 7.5 years ago. And I think back at that a lot, and that's frightening, and that scares me to death, and it's given me a lot of gratitude, you know, that I am here, and that I have been given a second lease on life. But the doctor stated that I probably picked something up when I was in Korea or Thailand. I would end up ingesting something, and that it
that would, long ago. I mean, it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, no. He says it's not out of the realm for something to attach onto something in your body and lay in a dormant state. And this is a very smart infectious disease doctor that said that. It is very rare, very extremely rare, but it's possible. And that's what they believe happened. When I woke up, I had several doctors that were examining my body, looking for scratches, looking for cuts, abrasions, anything that they could find on how and why I would end up having this brutal staph infection. Of course, you couldn't see it. So that's why it took all the diagnostics and everything else, to find out exactly what I had. But I still don't have an exact why. All they can give me are hypotheticals, if you will, are guesses.
Does that bother you?
It doesn't bother me. I would just love to know how I got it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, at this point in my life, I've forgiven everybody. You know, I've carried on with my life. I mean, it's something that you can't make up. And again, at this time, I'm just trying to figure out what in the hell has just hit me, and how am I, and beginning now, how am I going to carry on with the rest of my life? And that was the only thing I can think of. I've always been a provider of my family, the sole provider, the leader of my family, somebody that, that my family looks to for support and encouragement. And now I was the man that was broken and was on my knees, and I was in a very vulnerable and at risk time in my life. And that's when my family began to pick me up.
So what is the road to recovery start to look like? I know you mentioned you went to go see the doctor and you had so many, you know, they had already taken out what they had taken out. So what does the road to recovery look like?
Still going through it. Physical therapy, constantly stretches. The road to recovery, you know, after my surgery was tough because it was a lot of physical therapy, and it was a lot of walking and, traction. And I mean, just a lot of weird stuff and crazy massages and bladder.
How did they know that the staph infection was gone? I mean, they were able to ascertain it's 100% out, it's dead.
I did 6 months. I had in-home healthcare. They would come every Tuesday and change my dressing, and they would pull blood at home, and then they would take it off to the lab, and then I would get my lab results a couple days later. And that's how they would, send me my my antibiotics. So depending on what my levels were, sometimes they'd send more, sometimes they'd send less, but I would always do three large vials every single day. My wife had to unscrew the cap and then pump me full of very cold, thick IV antibiotics that would take about 5 minutes for it to go in. And it just made me sick. And, but yeah, this would happen for 4 months. So like I said, it took almost 4.5 to 5 months to completely rid my body of the infection. By the time that they had ridden my body of infection, my gut had been destroyed. the gut bacteria and the larvae that lives in your belly. And I lost so much weight. I think I had lost close to 60 pounds or something like that from the sudden onset of pain and to where I was at now in July, August, September. But the road to recovery would end up being very hard. I would end up really having a hard time walking, talking, balance issues. And at this time, my body began to show other signs and symptoms of other issues that were going on.
Like what?
Other parts of my spine were beginning to have the damage from the effects of my surgery. My T spine and my C spine.
How many surgeries have you had?
Three total. Well, I've probably had a dozen procedures. But, I've been scoped down every hole in my body multiple times, and that will continue for the rest of my life.
At what point in this do you decide that, hey, I need to fight back?
So it was I waited a year. I gave this a year to play out, because you have a 2-year statute of limitation to file a federal tort claim for malpractice and neglect. And they knew from the onset that they had screwed up, and the VA had claimed, responsibility from that publicly and stated that, I fell through the cracks.
So they openly took, responsibility for missing the diagnosis.
Oh, absolutely. They said I fell through the cracks. And so it wasn't until after they did a final spinal tap on me and they ran me through the CT scan. They're like, man, we're sorry, but you've got permanent spinal injuries. You're going to end up having some permanent cognitive type injuries. And your bladder, has been destroyed. You now have a neurogenic bladder, bladder paralysis. You got a bad kidney, you got horrible kidney renal function, and it's going to continue to progressively get worse and worse and worse as you age, with disc degeneration and all these, like, literally I could tell, I have a diagnosis list that's a mile long of everything that I suffer from on a daily basis as a chronic pain patient.
Was there a part of you that thought you might have been better off just dying?
At times, I had some very dark times in my room. You know, I sat there in despair, taking pills after pills after pills, and I would end up taking more pills at a lot of times than what I was supposed to, just because of the. Not just the physical pain, but the emotional, mental pain. We're a couple of years down the road now. After that, I find out that all the permanent injuries have happened. We file a tort claim. Okay, so we sue the federal government for malpractice and gross negligence, and because again, we find out it's all permanent. And we waited to make sure it was something that I wasn't going to be 100% to be recovered from. And at that time, I had already lost my truck, my work truck, my equipment, my business. Credit card debt was starting to stack up. And at this point now, my wife's doing everything that she can to stave off financial ruin. And now we've tapped into our savings, our life savings, and that was dwindling away. And so, you know, all we were just trying to do was to ensure that we didn't lose everything that I've ever worked so hard for in my entire life. And once we filed that tort claim, 6 months later, the VA gave me a call and they stated that it was a VA attorney. And she stated to me that the VA concluded that they failed to meet the standard of care and that there was a breach in liability and that they're going to be settling my claim. So we wouldn't lose everything that I've ever worked so hard for in my entire life and provided for my family in an honorable way. And 6 months after that phone call, we get a letter in the mail. It was 2 days before Thanksgiving, 2017. And it stated that we just found out that the doctor that we're holding responsible, the clinician that we're holding responsible for your injuries and your malpractice and negligence is an independent contractor. So the law from 1946 of the Federal Tort Claims Act states that a non-U.S. government employee, if a non-U.S. government employee makes a clinical error, that the United States government is not responsible for that action.
And to that, you said what over the phone? Or is it a letter? I'm sorry, you get a letter.
So they had already put me on my knees due to the medical malpractice and forever changed my life. And that letter was the kill shot that went right through my cranium. That was the kill shot. That's the shot that put me in a horrifying, deep, 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 dark spiral of anxiety and depression in my room where I didn't come out. I self-isolated for a very, very long time. Cried every single freaking day. I think I cried myself to sleep 10 times a day. I didn't come out of my room. The only time I came out of my room was on the weekends to go watch my sons play baseball and my daughter play softball. And other than that, that was my time out. And even when I was out, I didn't even want to be out. I just wanted to get back to my chair. That was my comfort zone. I would just sit in my chair and take my pills and just shake my head. And I'm like, well, we're going to end up probably losing this house. I'm going to go live in some apartment. I'm not going to ever, you know, at this time we've even lost our family vehicle. Like literally, like one day you're living the American dream. And then the next day you're just picking up the pieces. And it was very hard. It was very, very extremely hard. So at that time I pick up the phone, after the holiday and I call my congressman and I said, I need to schedule a meeting with the congressman. So it gets screened, you know, a bunch of times. Finally sat down with one of his staffers over the phone and I give him all this information and they said, okay, let us follow up with the VA. And they followed up the couple of letters. The VA would send back a couple of empty letters, just describing this conclusion that they had come to. As soon as my congressman started to get engaged in what was going on, he was indicted on federal charges and Congress lost all trust and confidence in my congressman and he was forced out of Congress.
Oh, I mean, dear Lord, how many more hurdles are they going to put in front of you?
Now I was the biggest case in the country when it came, when it come to the VA. And I was the only congressional district in the United States of America that didn't have a sitting member of Congress.
So what do you do?
I go back to my room, start taking pills, and I just wore out my chair. And finally, after all this agony and defeat and just living a nightmare, I got up one day when I was walking in my bathroom And I picked up a bunch of pills. I took them all. I leaned over my bathtub. I filled that sucker up with tears and put it all in the guy's hands and said, I'm about to take on the federal government. I don't have a congressman. No problem. I'm going to become my own member of Congress. I'm going to do the job that Congress has failed to do, and to draft my own bill then and hand deliver it to DC myself.
Okay. Do you know how to draft a bill for Congress?
No, okay. But I learned. Picked up a book. I recruited my own online legislative team. And from that day forward, that would be my new obsession. Every second, every minute, every hour of every single day was something that I called the tally bill. And I would put pen to paper, and I wrote everything that went wrong in my case. So I wrote down the problem, and then I would write a solution. I would draft the problem, and I would draft the solution. I would write the problem and draft the solution. And I kept doing that until I finally had everything in bill form. Then I would take it to a government teacher who taught high school government, and we put it into bill form. Then I sent it out to all these members of Congress via email, and I didn't get one email back. So I went to my wife, and I said, I know we don't have any money, but that credit card right there that we got a little bit of money on is going to get me a flight to DC. And I took a red eye, could barely even walk. And of course, I'm at this point in my life, I've gained so much weight. And again, just living this horrible life of anxiety and depression, filled my pockets up with pain pills and anxiety meds. And I would walk those halls of Congress going door to door, urging lawmakers to change an outdated law that has destroyed the lives of veterans and their families for generations. And the more I kept digging, the scarier and downright frightening this whole scenario became, because of the people don't usually make it from these. They end up dying through the actual malpractice themselves, or they end up just taking their own lives because of the anguish again and the stress that that the VA and that the bureaucratic system will put the veterans through and their families through. I know if I would have been dead, okay, from this, there's no way my wife could have fought in this. There's just too much involved here. There's too many players. There's too much criminal activity that took place. There was a lot of government type cover up. That took place and really would end up setting up this ball game, if you will, on perhaps what I've, you know, been training for my entire life. And that's to use every life skill that I've ever had put in front of me. And I would have to pull every single tool that I had in my tool bag out to begin this fight, to begin lobbying, to become an advocate. I mean, I'm not an advocate. I'm not a lobbyist, but I learned. And I would show up there, like I said, and I would speak very clearly and very confidently. And I had a consistent message, and it was simple, and it was to overturn that law. And let me tell you why it's so important. The VA has been watering down malpractice numbers for generations, because if they could bring in independent contractors, nobody knows who they are. They wear VA badges, VA doctor's coats. They have VA laptops. They see VA patients. They have keys to the building. They use the printers, the faxers, the copy paper machine. If that's you, if that's me, we're labeled as employees. But they call themselves independent contractors. They're employees until they get in trouble. And then once they get in trouble, they're independent contractors. And again, you don't know who the independent contractors are because they look the same. They look just like an employee does. So nobody knows the classifications of all these, you know, employees versus the independent contractor clause. But in my case, what the VA did, it was it became so criminal because they cherry picked the fall guy. There was 11 or 12 clinicians failed to meet the standard of care, but one was an independent contractor. they put her in the number one position. So I couldn't, so the VA, so they denied everything else based on a technicality and an employment status. Again, that was written in 1946. But what they did even crazier is that they held on to this information. Once they sent that letter to me and stated that we're no longer responsible, an independent contractor is the one to blame, you need to sue her in state court. Well, when I got that letter, my California state statute of limitations had already expired by 2 days. So they effectively now at this point denied my right to due process in federal court and denied my right to due process in state court. And the VA protected their independent contract doctor from getting any bad paper on her. We couldn't even go to the National Practitioners Data Bank because the time had already ran on that. And when you're doing a federal tort claim in a situation like mine, where it's so hard to find an attorney, it's so hard to have anybody answer the phone. And then you got to tell them the same story over and over and over and over again. You tell them it's VA malpractice and they don't want to touch it because it's such a mess.
They're going to lose, though. I mean, they as you've just alluded to, the government can bury you in paperwork. They can bury you in deadlines and delays and everything else. It's a machine, and it's a self-preserving, self-sustaining machine that puts itself in front of everything else. Like, and I don't say that as a disgruntled American. I just say it as a matter of fact that that's the way government runs. When you're sitting here in front of all this, and like, again, how many more roadblocks can they throw in front of you? How many times did you want to quit?
Oh, man. When I got engaged in this, it was something that I was going to see all the way through because I promised myself, but I had a lot of really bad days. I leaned on one guy, John Steelman. It was somebody that I ended up serving with my whole entire time in the Marine Corps. And he's the one that kept me grounded. I would go off on him every single day and then I'd be done with it, you know, cause I would always keep my composure, out in the public eye and stuff like that. But don't get me wrong, the level of frustration and the level of fear, that I had, you know, was unlike anything I could have ever imagined, you know, especially once we started to peel this onion back. And once that started to happen, I said, there is absolutely no way that I can continue living my life knowing what I know now, and not do something about it. It's my duty as an American.
It's just so, I'm just trying to process this all. That's the problem. I mean, it's just, it's so much to undertake. Was there somebody else along the way, somebody within Congress who saw this and decided to help you run with it? Or was this really just you alone? Like, somebody's got to help carry the ball with you, don't they?
Yeah, sure. So I went in there and again, I did the job of a member of Congress. I got it to the point to, I influenced enough members of Congress to where they took my bill that I had drafted, put it into their bill form with their professional staffers. And at that time, Congressman Dave Bratt, Virginia 7th Congressional District, would end up formally presenting and my bill to Congress that would be HR 7105. And that was the start. That was the beginning of the tally bill in Congress and it finally getting, out there for people to see and for the VA to know that, hey, you know, I think this guy's trying to change this law and they didn't want that, you know, for sure, because this has been a big cash cow for the VA and it's been something that's been very effective for them for a very long time, this whole independent contract clause and running the time and the clocks on injured veterans that have been, you know, again, injured due to no fault of their own. You know, you look at livelihoods, my livelihood was stripped away from me due to no fault of my own and it hurt. Now I was getting ready to volunteer every single second of my life that I had. And the problem that I had with it is because, look, I had spent a very long time in my life being neglected, and I was neglecting myself. And at the time the emotional and the mental pain was so much that I almost had a couple of heart attacks because of how hard I pushed this bill in Congress. I would have anxiety and panic attacks. I would have to end up in the ERs several times because this became my number one goal in life, and this became my number one obsession. I wanted to move on with my life, but I couldn't move on with my life, Mark, knowing that that this law was still out there. I needed closure, and the only closure that I was going to get is to see this bill signed into law to put an end to the very law that ruined my life.
So it is when the congressman from Virginia takes it. Is that the first crack of light at the end of the tunnel for you?
That was the first crack, and that right there is what put me on the map, if you will.
What was it open?
It opened that a member of Congress and six other people that signed on to that bill saw a problem in the VA, and they wanted to help fix it. You know,
just one problem in the VA, just one. A kid.
That was just a problem that I had seen and drafted a solution to, if
right.
you will.
No, sure. And again, so I apologize. I wasn't laughing at making a joke at you, but you know, the VA is the VA. So, look, and I'll say this much, you know,
but the most important thing is it gave me credibility because I was in there fighting honorably. I was killing them with kindness. I was going to both chambers, Senate and the House, Democrats, Republicans alike, liberals, progressives. It didn't matter. The veteran community is comprised of 20.2 million American veterans. And I was going to go in there and I was going to represent all 20.2 million American veterans in an honorable way. The same way I serve, you know, with the hallmarks of a Marine, honor, courage, and commitment. And nobody knew what my political affiliation was because I didn't tell them. I didn't think it was important. What was important was closing this legal loophole that would essentially give every single veteran in this country the right to due process and a clear path of legal recourse once they've been injured or killed due to no fault of their own.
All right. So you get this crack of light here and the ball starts moving forward. I'm curious as to when this bill starts to get presented. I mean, obviously, for those who don't know how government works, you know, there's people who can object to a bill and state their reasons why and get on the floor of Congress and pound the podium and tell everybody this is this and this is that, and I believe this and I believe that, and they could speak for hours on end. Did you start to see other Congress members resist the tally bill?
No.
Okay. That must have been a relief, at least.
The only people that stood in the way were the VA.
Well, that I get, like, you know, for them, it's self-preservation, right? They have a vested interest in protecting this, you know, your whole bill from not happening. I just was curious if anybody else, you know, on the floor of Congress and, you know, said, yeah, you know what, this guy's not right. He's not, you know, this is the way for a reason. And, you know, this is a thing that works for us. But nobody said that.
They would have committed career suicide and would have been labeled a criminal at that point if they were going to do that because of the clear of exactly what happened and how the dates and all this stuff had formulated to come into fruition. When you cherry pick a clinician based on an employment status, you know that they're going to have clear immunity. And you put her in the number one position. So now nobody else below her gets to get sued federally. And then you then you state by a matter of fact and conclude that we did screw up. We're going to settle your claim. So what they do at that time, they relaxed us. Okay, we're not going to lose everything. We just have to be patient. And then at the 1 year mark, boom, they drop the bombshell. Threw us all under the bus and left me and my family holding the bag. And again, that was the kill shot that put me in motion to make this change.
Were you on the House floor for the vote?
Well, and it was the 115th Congress. Dave Brat would formally introduce H.R. 7105. It would end up dying in Congress. So that bill would die, and I would have to start all over again.
Oh, God. How much was that? How much of a gut punch was that?
Oh, it was a big gut punch. We didn't have time, you know, and that's another problem with our country is that we have two-year Congress. So you have 1 year to do work, and you have 1 year to get reelected. And that's exactly how the cycles work. I spent 3.5 years in Congress. I have over 11,000 hours of advocacy. I've seen stuff in D.C. that most people can't even fathom or will never see in 5 or 6 different lifetimes. I've been in rooms on the 7th and 8th floor of the VA meeting with undersecretaries and VA secretaries and the former chief of staff of President Trump, Mark Meadows. I mean, I've seen it. I know how D.C. works, and I became very good at what I did very quickly because I needed to, because I was tired, Mark. I was very tired. I needed to see this bill through because, again, I could not begin to heal myself mentally, emotionally, and physically until this bill was passed because it was my, not only my life goal, but it was my obsession that I needed.
I was going
to
say, did your wife ever say to you, you know, hey, Brian, this is consuming you. Like this is,
Yeah. But she also knew how important it was because she was a victim of it too.
Yes. Well, obviously.
So was my family. You know, it's not like it was just, you know, me, you know, my whole family felt the effect of this. And all the emails I started to get, all the messages on Facebook and all these different social media platforms saying the same thing happened to me, the same thing happened to me. Oh my God, I can't believe that. We're behind you, Tally, and we're going to rally behind you. And then that's when the whole rally around Tally movement began, and the media would end up getting involved, and then my story would break nationally.
Okay, so take me through those events.
I would end up going to DC 5 different times, and when the whole rally around Tally thing started, people were donating funds to me. I didn't have any suits, ties, or anything like that. So people would say, "Hey, man, you know, here's $200. Go get a suit jacket and a tie or whatever." You know, I was a guy that wore boots and blue jeans, dipped Copenhagen, and drank beer after work. You know what I mean? And you know, I operated equipment and built.
How American of you!
Beautiful landscapes, you know, and so that's, you know, what I did. And now I found myself lobbying and wearing dress shoes and dress pants and presenting legislation to influence members of Congress to do their job and to do the right thing and act immediately. Because now, as I sit here, I was saying we have veterans at risk, 20.2 million American veterans at risk right now until we act. We got to act on this. We know what the problem is. I have hand delivered you a solution. You don't even need to do the work. It's done. It's done. So when I went back in the 116th Congress, I already had assets built from the 115th Congress. So I would go back to a lot of those same members of Congress. And I would go back to those same assets I built with professional staffers and all the way down to the greeter who would greet you when you walked them through those doors because they're just as important because they know everything. They see everything. And so I had intel. I know who wanted to sign on the bill. And I started to gain more traction and more momentum as the story picked up more steam. I would do TV. It was in all the military publications. And then before you knew it, immediately thereafter, the 116th Congress started. Congressman Mark Meadows gave me a call and said, "We're going to take your bill and we're going to run with it." And that's when H.R. 3813 was formally introduced in Congress, the Brian Tally VA Employment Transparency Act. And then at that time, I needed to go to the Democrat side. And you've got to understand, Mark, I'm doing this in the most divided Congress in the history of our country. So how was I going to get a Democrat and a Republican alike to come together, to sit at the same table and to mutually agree that this is a problem in the United States of America and a problem in the VA and a problem for all these veterans out there? And so I went and I found a Democrat, Congressman Mike Levin. I brought Levin and I brought Meadows to the same table. And they said, nah, we're not going to sign on to this. So I couldn't find a Democrat. Why couldn't I find a Democrat? Because Mark Meadows was considered to be a firecracker in Congress. We had every Republican signing on to that bill, but I couldn't get a Democrat to sign on to that bill. It wasn't because they didn't like the legislation. They didn't like Meadows. So I had to go to Levin and say, look, if you introduce your own bill and I got Meadows to sign on to it, would you allow that to happen? And they said, yes. So.
Petty MFers, man. Dear Lord.
So Congressman Mike Levin and his staff would come to the table with H.R. 4526, my third bill. So H.R. 4526 would be introduced in the 116th Congress. And then I went back to Meadows and I said, Meadows, can you sign on to the Democrat bill? The Democrat version of the tally bill, and he agreed. So now I was having Republicans come over and Democrats, and everything was great.
Can you share a little bit more of that conversation? Was he resistant to it at all? Was he disgusted by it? Was he angry that you had to flip it? I mean, what was some of his emotions?
Well, a lot of this stuff was being done by staffers.
Okay,
and no, there was a lot of pissed off people, if you will, because they were playing political football now with one of the most important veteran bills that had been introduced in quite some time, because it wasn't lives are at risk here. And it's just not lives, but it was the criminal intent that was going on at the highest levels of the Department of Veterans Affairs. And when most veterans talk about this, they get labeled as being crazy or whatever. And that's where I think I had a lot of really great success, because I'm a family guy. I didn't go out and party. I worked hard and I come home and I provide for my beautiful family. And that's all I did. And so I had a great public community reputation. I was a guy that I was the life of the party. I was an outgoing guy. I was a guy that always had a smile on his face. I was, so they couldn't label me as crazy when I had a lot of very great friends in very high places writing letters on my behalf and recommendations and all this other stuff. And then I had my brother get involved, who's a big time Series 7, Series 8 financial advisor and planner and stock guy who's very, very well versed when it comes to a lot of law. And he's a 10-year veteran, combat veteran of U.S. Air Force. He was a crew chief on C-17s. And, and he's a bright guy. And, and he was picking things out. And, so once we got H.R. 4526 to the table, then I brought it to the Senate. Again, if it wasn't for me doing the work, this bill wouldn't have gone anywhere. It wouldn't have gotten anywhere because they didn't really want to change it. And so at this point now, everything's flowing. Everything's looking good. I get a letter in February of 2020 was like February 1st of 2020 saying, congratulations, you have been, your bill has been selected for committee and you are hereby requested to appear in March 24th, whatever, 2020. To testify in front of committee, in front of Congress and the VA committee. 2 weeks later, COVID hits. Boom. Brick wall.
Oh, my God. I can't believe the number of hurdles that keep getting in your way.
I had so many outs. And you know what? If I would have quit, people would have been like, you gave it your best.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like you quit. It was like you had to walk away. But again, my mind was so
laser focused.
It wouldn't let me quit.
Yeah.
I didn't have this quit in me. Now I was getting angrier and angrier, yeah. But for the first time in my life, since January of 2016, I had found purpose again. And I was beginning to reinvent myself. And I was beginning to recreate myself. And I was beginning to figure out who I would become in this second chapter of my life, because I wasn't going to be the contractor I was anymore. Right. I had lost all passion for the landscaping and everything I used to love doing. And now my passion was influencing members of Congress and their staff into doing the right thing to take care of 20.2 million American veterans. My new purpose in life was veteran policy and how I was going to see the tally bill all the way across the finish line. So when
you testify in front of Congress.
I'm sorry?
You end up testifying in front of Congress.
I got canceled because of COVID.
Right. So that never happened though?
It would end up happening. But here's another big part of the story is that when everybody got up and went inside for COVID, that's when I got up and I went outside. So when all this stuff was going on, I'm like, I can't not stay in front of what's going on out there, because at this time we've got cities burning now. We've got, you know, all this stuff going on in the country, you know, when it comes to police, injustices and this and that. And we've got riots going on. We've got COVID going on. Everything is shut down. So I got in my car and I drove 7 states in 6 days and I visited every congressional district in my way. And even though they weren't there, I would go there. I would leave letters and I would do like Facebook posts and lives and all that stuff. There's some of the people were there, but the majority of them weren't. But I would leave letters. I would slide it underneath their door. And that worked. I was gaining a lot more members of Congress because they were now learning the stories. And then I would go hit all these VFWs. The VFWs were packed full of people that were in there drinking beer. And I would go in there and I would do, and I would walk in, I would go right to the bartender and say, who's the commander in here? And they'd say, that guy right there. And I'd go to him and say, hey, my name's Brian Talley. Here's my mission. Can I speak in front of all these people? Give me 10 minutes. And I did that all over these 7 states. And I started to get it out there even more to an even broader audience. And once COVID and all that stuff started to kind of simmer down a little bit, I would end up having my day in front of Congress. However, it would be like this. It would be over Zoom. And the great news is about this is I had members of Congress in there saying my name on the Congress floor, going to bat and say, put yourself into Brian Talley's shoes and all these other, and the VA didn't know what to say. So when they were pounded by Congress, pounded, I'm talking pounded, their Zoom, it disconnected.
You gotta be shitting me.
No. So then it passed right out of committee. Like, well, we're passing it. So it advanced to the House. And once that happened, I went to the Senate. I started shopping the bill. I very quickly found a Democrat and a Republican. It was Blumenthal and Tillis. And I said, look, let's make this bicameral. And I did. And now we're running out of time in the 116th Congress. We're getting into, I want to say it was early November.
Yeah.
They finally came together. And now there's another bill introduced, bill number 4. Senate Bill 4883 was introduced. And now we had bicameral, bipartisan
support
legislation. Yeah. In both chambers. It passed the House. It passed the Senate. It needed to go to President Trump. So I would end up getting this bill to the president's desk in the most divided and insanely dysfunctional Congress, again, in the history of our country. And the bill would sit on his desk for 9 days. Until he signed it on the 10th day. Folks, if a bill is passed in both chambers, it goes to the president's desk. If he doesn't sign it, within 10 days, that bill dies in Congress. So on the 10th day, President Trump signed it, and that was January 5th of 2021. So I was one day away for that thing being dead and gone in Congress. And then we all know what happened on January 6th. So again, it's funny that my story ends like that, because it was another, it could have been another major roadblock, but you start to say, okay, something that happened that, I mean, my story is so unprecedented that there's like five things in my story that have never happened before in this country. You know, like the infection that I had, less than 0.00001% of a chance that you're going to get that and then survive it and then live with it for 4 months and then not have a member of Congress. How many people in this country don't have a member of Congress? Well, in California, that was a Republican seat. And so Gavin Newsom didn't want to hold a special election. Again, everything that could have went wrong, went wrong.
Yeah.
Everything. But I stayed the course. I was like, you know what? I've got to be a champion here. And I tell you what, on that day that it became law in January of 2021, I mean, I shook for many hours. I mean, I think I even had an anxiety attack for a minute there. I didn't even know what to do, think, whatever, all these, you know, this 11,000 advocacy and the thousands of phone calls and emails and the team I set up and established and the five trips to DC and the fundraisers and everything associated with it and how I presented myself in an honorable way. And I would again, work in a way that would honor my name, not dishonor my name, and to speak to all these members of Congress with respect, and still get my point across, being in a very, you know, articulate type manner without losing your bearing. The problem is with so many veterans these days, they get so angry at the VA when something bad happens, they can't get through their care provider. And then when they finally do, they go off on the lady that's just trying to answer the phone. And the problem is that once that you do that in Congress, they turn you off. So once I had a seat at the table, I never gave up my seat until my mission was complete. And I damn sure earned my seat at the table, because I've done more in Congress than the majority of members in Congress that are in there right now serving, and the ones that have served. Every single one of these bills behind me right now, you know, those are all bills that I worked very, very hard on, drafted my own time, blood, sweat, tears, and dime, to ensure that this 74-year VA legal loophole would be closed. And it's changed my life forever. I think about it every single day. My life now revolves around veterans. It revolves around helping veterans. I mean, I have hundreds of messages that pour in from throughout the country on a daily basis, hundreds on a monthly basis, dozens on a daily basis, from all walks of life, from Gold Star moms and dads to aunts, nieces, nephews, wives, girlfriends, or the veteran themselves, on what's going on and the problems they're facing and what kind of, you know. And I'm like, guys, I'm not a 501c3. I'm not a this or that. I'm just a guy that went through a lot of issues with the VA. But anytime you Google something that has anything to do with the VA, I pop up. I've become like the champion for VA reform and policy. And that's fine. I think I owe it to them to say, okay, maybe they're at the end of their rope. And I never had a Brian Talley when I needed a Brian Talley the most. So I teach them how to become their own versions, you know, and how to advocate for themselves. And I have a lot of good educational tools now that I can share with them, because I know it works. You know, I kind of created a blueprint on how to effectively engage in a positive manner to get things done in Congress, even when the impossible seems so impossible that it's so far-fetched that it could never happen. It did.
Was the juice worth the squeeze, so to speak? Does getting this bill passed make all the physical pain and emotional suffering you went through, does it make it worth it?
I tell people this all the time. When you're happy, it's a lot easier to manage pain. When you're sad, the pain will compound like interest. But me, I'm down to 12 pills a day. I'm living the American dream again. But it does take me a little while to get up and get going in the morning. You know, I do suffer again from a lot of pain, but I'm happy. I've been getting 1% better every single day, you know, since about 2020.
Right.
And, you know, I've changed my diet. I changed my life. I'm focused on other things now, other than just passing a bill constantly every second of every minute of every hour of every single day. I'm able to live again. I have that mental closure. But this job came without a paycheck. And yeah. That's the thing. People say, how did you remain so engaged and not receiving any compensation or a paycheck for all the hard work you're doing? You know, the way it works in the United States of America and pretty much in the world is when you work, you're rewarded at the end of a week with a paycheck. But my rewards came in bill introductions. My rewards came when the media did a story. My rewards came when somebody would call me and say, thank you for the hard work that you're putting in for the veteran community. We really need this to be changed. So when this happens again, it doesn't ruin another family. That was my paycheck.
You said earlier that you've forgiven everybody. I guess two-part question. One, how'd you get there? And two, if the bill doesn't pass, would you still forgive everybody?
Oh, I forgave everybody long before I even drafted the bill.
Interesting.
I said, you know what? Accidents look okay. So on the doctor side, malpractice and negligence is going to happen whether you're in a VA hospital or a civilian hospital. People are human and humans make mistakes. There's a lot of mistakes that took place that day and a lot of errors that took place over the course of 4 months that nearly cost me my life, but did cost me so much of my life. Again, my livelihood, my business, my family car, a rental home, my life savings, and my physical health, my mental health, emotional. I mean, I lost so much, but I'm like, okay, that's an accident. Okay.
There's more on your side of the ledger than theirs that when it comes to loss here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I am like, well, I can't just sit and harp on this. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to move on and I'm going to try to figure it out here. And again, it was a lot of figuring out, and, you know, again, when you're up against, you know, do you live or do you check out? You know, I always chose that live box, but that checkout box had been swiped a few times, but I just had to continue to always stay in the fight and uncheck it and get back over on this side here on my ex where I needed to be. When it comes to the legal malpractice side, have I completely forgiven the people that have railroaded me? Yes, and I had to. It was all part of my closure. I can never live a jaded life. People that I know that live a jaded life, they live a very they live a life of they live a bad like they're always in a bad mood, and that the world, you know, that, you know, they hate the world and this and that. I'm not that type of guy. I could very easily carry a lot of anger, when I don't need to. I accomplish what I set out to do. Those guys on the seventh floor of the VA Office of General Counsel now will forever see my last name inked into federal law. And so at the end of the day, I won, and I don't need to be angry. I don't need to carry anything with me, no ill will or anything, because I could sleep at night. And perhaps maybe those men can't, because of the of so many families of good men and women that have been destroyed by these legal loopholes, again, that you don't really even know exist until you're in that web. And once you get into that web, you can't get out of it. And that web will swallow you up. And very rarely do you ever come out of that web. And very rarely do you ever come out of that web with a solution to end it.
I can't speak for everybody listening to this and watching this show, but if you're a veteran and you're hearing this and you've been to the VA, this is just the comprehension of how big this thing got is beyond the scope of my tiny little brain. And I can't believe that you fought as long and as hard as you did. There are so many other, for lack of a better word to phrase it, there are so many better people at this who would have quit. There are so many more professional people at that whole thing that would have quit. And it's a testament to, you know, your fortitude and to your belief in yourself and your family and dedication to this whole thing that is much bigger than I could ever accomplish and a lot of other people could ever accomplish. And look, we're a better, stronger force because of your efforts. And that is a legacy that I think, despite all the pain and suffering, probably sleep pretty decent at night. I mean, you know, I trade legacies with you, put it that way.
When I tell my story, I get, my hands are clammy. I'm sweating profusely right now. My heart's beating. It hurts me. To relive the days and all the moments of when literally we thought we were going to just become homeless, and my kids are looking at me and they're seeing their dad in this fight, and they're seeing their dad that they know is being this big, tough, strong Marine that has completely been folded up like a lawn chair and crushed like a freaking can and completely tossed on the side of the road to just be ran over again and again and again. And once I looked at myself in the mirror and I saw how far gone that I had been and the amount of pills and the amount of mental anguish that I had been through, I promised myself to say, you know what? I need to set an example for my kids. Because they're watching me. They're watching everything that I do. If I quit, I'm going to raise a bunch of quitters. If I stay in this fight, remain positively engaged, and just keep moving and just keep chopping wood and just keep swimming slow as fast. The wheels of justice move very, very slow. But if you just stay in the fight and always, always, always inspire yourself and keep encouraging yourself that one day all your work and the blood, sweat, tears, and the commitment and the strength through determination that you put into something will happen. And so now I know I've raised a bunch of people that are never going to quit because they've seen firsthand what dad almost did, but dad didn't quit. He stayed in the fight. He stayed engaged. And then he won at the end. He got his bill across the finish line. He's a champion. And that makes me feel good because my family and my kids always tell me how proud of, they always tell me how proud they are. And I always tell them how proud I am of them. I have awesome kids. I mean, beautiful athletes, educated. I'm talking like they got the looks, man. They got it all. I don't know, mama's genes. You know what I mean? So, that's what I just try to tell everybody right now, man. You know, it's like there's so many people that come to me. Hey, how do I draft my own bill? How can I do this? How can I do that? So I know I've inspired so many people out there that are going through a lot of struggles of their own, and they have their own great ideas. And that's what is so important in this country. We're living in a time right now where advocates are so important. And people, they feel as if they don't have a voice. Well, I got news for you. You have a voice. You just need to learn how to use your voice in a positive way that could add value,
that can add value to whatever it is you're trying to change, and have that power of communication and influence to sit down with somebody at the same table, even though you may not agree with them, but to come to a common conclusion that there's something that needs to be done, and how can we attack it? How can we attack it together as Americans? And not to be afraid and not to be scared, and remove yourself from that chair. Take yourself out of that comfort zone. Put yourself into that game. I remember you said, hey, I was on the sidelines. Yeah, until I wasn't, until I put myself into the game. And now I'm in the game. I'm in the game all the time. I'm no longer on the sidelines of anything. I've put myself in the game, and I'm never coming out. I'm that guy that's playing every single ball game, 162 games in the MLB, and then I'll play all 17 in the NFL. You put me in the NHL, play another 82 game, you know, whatever. I'm on the field. Yeah, and I'm never coming off that field again. They're going to have to drag me off, because that's where I belong now. I belong in the veteran advocacy world, because I have got to give every veteran out there a voice. And that is my job moving forward. And that will be my legacy moving forward. And that's what God has wanted me to do. And we're all called in life. And I was called to serve. And I sincerely believe that. And I answered that call to service. And my reward has come true. And that reward is that we closed the loophole, and no other veteran is ever going to fall victim to that. And my reward is having the strength and the courage and the stamina to write a book. I didn't choose this job. It chose me. There's so much more about my story that's in that book. It's a very quick read. Lots of pictures. The pictures tell the story. Because when you talk about it, you're like, no way. It's not even, it doesn't even sound real.
Right.
And I'm like, how did this happen? Sometimes you just can't put words to it. But I was able to write a book. You know, again, that took a lot of, it took a lot of energy, you know, because when I got done with that, I didn't have anything left in the tank. I did not have anything left in the tank. But, you know, I'm getting 1% better every single day, man. And that's what I always do. And that's what I credit to, you know, is, you know, my faith, my family, and of course, my country.
Well, look, number one, I'll say thank you, because the efforts are just so monumental. So for me, thank you. But on behalf of, you know, veterans and everybody who listens to it and watches the show, thank you. And yeah, we always build a kind of show of tales of combat and survival. Well, this is a tale of combat and survival for you in multiple ways. And I'm glad that you were able to sit down and tell it with us. Real quick, before we wrap up, not only do you have the book, but you have the podcast every week, Tuesdays with Tally. All right. That's the name of it, correct?
Today with Tally.
Today with Tally. Okay. So they can get it anywhere they get podcasts and everything else.
Yeah, it was pretty much 1 year ago Thursday here coming up. So like 363 days ago, I was just out on a walk, and God put this podcast in my heart, because, again, I get so many veterans that reach out to me. And it's like, hey, you're going to start a podcast, and it's going to be called Tuesdays with Tally at the time. And then I became obsessed with it, and I finally named it Today with Tally, because I do a lot of them. I've done 188 episodes in 363 days, and I've had a lot of really great guests. And the whole mission behind my podcast is to add real life value to the lives of everyday people. And with all the messages that veterans were sending me, I was like, how can I communicate with a large group of people without having the same say the same thing over and over and over again? So I've done a lot of podcasts on how to effectively advocate, you know, how to, you know, positively fight, and how to stay in the fight, how to stay engaged, and how to just never give up and just never quit by having on awesome guests and, you know, to tell their stories, as, you know, as well, of perseverance and resilience and what it's like to can live a better life. It just takes a lot of discipline, and it takes you hitting rock bottom, you know, and I talk about that a lot of the times. What was my rock bottom, and what did it look like? Well, rock bottom for me was the best and worst day of my life, you know, because it was the best day, because it didn't get worse than that day, and it was the worst day because of how bad it was, you know, but you can never really start to heal yourself until you have that moment. And once you hit that moment, you don't like how it feels, only you can change you. And so that's what the podcast is about.
Awesome. BrianTally.com. Brian, T-A-L-L-Y, is where you can go to get more information on the podcast, on the book, ask Brian to come speak to you, whatever it may be. Again, BrianTally.com. Well, look, I am so glad you spent some time with us today. So thank you so much for doing so and sharing your story. Name of the book, again, I Didn't Choose This Job. This Job Chose Me. You can get anywhere you get books as well. I mean, just wow. I mean, it's like I told you when I first wrote it, I'm just wow. Like, I don't, you know, this is beyond the scope. So thank you so much for sharing your story, Brian. Continued success in all your endeavors and your veterans advocacy. But to you and your family, thank you. Hopefully while you're in the middle of the fight and you're not on the sidelines anymore, you still got some time for the wife and the kids and some family time for you, because you deserve it. You absolutely.
I live every day with a ton of gratitude, and I'm with my family 24/7, 365 and a quarter. And yes, we've been making up a lot of lost time, and it's great, you know, and the kids learned a lot. I learned a lot. Just one day at a time, man. Just one day at a time. Life is fragile.
It's great to have you here. And we always say, Brian Tally, thank you for being part of the Hazard Ground.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate you having me.
You've been listening to the Hazard Ground Podcast, hosted by Mark Zeno. If you have an interesting story to tell and you'd like to be on the show, send us an email at producer@hazardground.com. And if you like the show, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.